It is my pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, John D. Koons. He is the chairman and CEO of Koons Brothers, a boutique investment banking firm, and of the China Hand Fund, a private equity organization with investments in Chinese companies. Mr. Koons has closed five IPOs of companies he has created. Most recently in 2006, Mr. Koons founded China Hydroelectric Corporation, the largest foreign owner and operator of hydroelectric projects in China, which closed its IPO on the New York Stock Exchange in January 2010. Mr. Koons received his undergraduate degree from Georgetown University, where he was also captain of the varsity football team and was a member of the university's Athletic Hall of Fame. He received a Master of Fine Arts from the University of Chicago, where he was a teaching assistant in sculpture and drawing and the art critic for the university's newspaper. He received an MBA from the Harvard Business School. Author of China Fortunes, a novel published in January 2011 by John Wiley and Sons, Mr. Koons hopes to publish his second novel about smuggling over the Chinese-Burmese border next year. He is a frequent contributor on matters involving China to Bloomberg, CNBC, and other media, and he is an avid fly fisherman. Would you please welcome John Koons?
Thank you, Cynthia, and my thanks to the club for inviting me here, and thank all of you tonight for coming. I see some old friends in the audience and others who I don't know, but I'm very appreciative of all of you coming here tonight on such a miserable evening outside. So, let's get started here. I'm here to talk about two parallel subjects. They really are parallel, believe it or not. The first, this is supposed to be a pun, a dry subject, is my 25-year plus or minus career in the hydroelectric industry, which spans experiences around the world, including prominently both the United States and the People's Republic of China. Yeah, you can go ahead and close that door. Thank you. And the second parallel discussion point is the publication of my novel, China Fortunes, which is about, predictably, an American businessman pursuing the hydroelectric business first in the United States and then in China. For the dry topic first, just to get you introduced, I'm the founder, chairman, and CEO of China Hydroelectric Corporation, which is listed on the New York Stock Exchange under the symbol CHC. And we are the largest, what's called, small hydroelectric corporation in the People's Republic of China. In China, they define small hydro as any station under 50 megawatts. 50 megawatts, as some of you may know, is not a small station. A 50-megawatt power plant can supply, in the United States, probably a city of 40,000 people. In China, can probably supply a city of 200,000 people because they're much more frugal with their resources. We own 26 operating stations, aggregating just under 550 megawatts. And together with my Chinese partner, who I'll mention later, Dr. Yusu Lin, we started this company from scratch in June of 2006. And then the more interesting subject, here's, by the way, one of our projects. This happens to be a 42-megawatt facility in the Zhejiang province. Hangzhou is the capital there, and it's a very rich hydroelectric area. I'm also the author, as Cynthia was saying, of China Fortunes, the book I mentioned. It is my first novel. I don't expect it to be my last, subject to the whim of the publishers. I had to talk to at least a dozen publishers before I got Wiley to take me on, but that's, I think, fairly typical. Come on in and have a seat. The interesting thing about China Fortunes, for some, is that everything in the book, if you do get a chance to read it, is true, except the girlfriends. I essentially... well, it's not a part that can continue in the novel. I submitted my first manuscript to Wiley, and they sent it back and said, you know, we could probably take this on. And by the way, Wiley is a fairly conservative institution. But, John, you're going to need a little pizzazz. So if you do get a chance to read China Fortunes, everything that happened in China Fortunes, for example, Don, yes, me stealing the car when I was 13 years old really happened, except the girlfriends. But you're probably wondering what can be interesting enough about a very prosaic subject like starting and managing a hydroelectric company, and can anybody involved with a hydroelectric company be able to write a paragraph? And as I say here, as far as the writing, you'll have to be the judge, which is a fervent plea to buy the book. I'll make no bones about it. But there's a lot of interesting topic out there. It usually helps if you know something well. Many of you have probably heard the expression managing by wandering around. I forget, Lucian, who came up with that. Who was it? Probably Tom Peters or somebody like that. I can't claim any significant success at managing by wandering around, but I've learned a lot by wandering around. What another way of saying that is I never had a plan which guided me to where I've ended up. It was always kind of taking one thing at a time. And it was a pretty serendipitous journey, starting with my only goal in high school and college, and that was to play professional football. Some of my friends here are from Washington, where I grew up, and I started playing for the University of Virginia. I ended up my career at Georgetown. I tried out for both the Redskins and the Cowboys, but George Allen, who was the coach then, said, "Coons, you're 2 inches too short, 2 steps too slow, get out of here." And that was the end of my college and potential professional career. So I had to figure out something to do, and without asking me, my sculpture professor at the University of Chicago, I was an art student at the University of Chicago, not because I was trying to get out of the difficult courses, but I really truly was very interested and involved in art. My art professor, Leonard Cave, sent my portfolio to the University of Chicago, and they accepted it. And when I got cut from those two teams and I took the summer off to absorb my disappointment, I had a fellowship to the University of Chicago waiting for me. But just like my NFL career, I was not the next Picasso. And I actually did the plaster work for this sculpture, which is in a park right off of Lake Michigan, right south of the university. The man who I worked for, he was a sculptor in residence at the University of Chicago. His name is Virginio Ferrari. There was another Spaniard there named Cosmo Campoli, and I was their assistant. And their nickname for me was the Master of Plaster, because before this can be a bronze cast, which we had done for us in Milano, it has to be plaster first. And so I was the assistant that built this thing out of plaster, which was fun, but it was a 14-hour day. It gave me a lot of time to think about what I really should be doing. And I was 22, 23 years old at the time. And what do people do when they're 22 or 23 years old? Don't know what they do, what they want to do, and are reasonably well-adjusted. They call their mother. And so I called my mother and I said, "Mom, I have no idea what I'm going to do. I've struck out twice here." And she gave me some very sensible advice. She said, "Take an aptitude test." And so I did that. I went down to Human Resources at the University of Chicago and took an aptitude test. And they said I should either go into the armed forces or into general management. Can you imagine? Like, they equated them, right? And I didn't think anything more about that aptitude test until something happened which was going to change my life forever. I was, in addition to being a graduate teaching assistant at the University of Chicago, so I taught the undergraduates sculpture and drawing, I was the art critic for the Chicago Maroon, which is the university newspaper. And one day I was filing the galleys for my story. You used to have to file the stories manually in typeset every Friday. There was a little ad in the galleys right next to where my article was being slugged in saying, "Harvard MBA, ? So, again, I was still the same guy. Picked up the phone, called my mother, because I had no idea what a Harvard MBA was. Now, keep in mind that I'm dating myself here, but I graduated from university in 1972. Vietnam War era. Nobody except my friend Don Macero here always knew he was going to be involved in industry, was going to admit they were going to join the military-industrial complex, right? So I not only wasn't going to admit it, I had no idea that anything like a business school was out there. So my mother told me about it, and so I decided to go to the coffee hour next day. And the bottom line is, I got into Harvard Business School as what they used to call then, and they probably still do, a token poet. In other words, somebody to round out the class, where smart guys like Lucian Ruby here, who's an engineer from Duke, would give us, the rest of us, guidance. And so I did get into Harvard, and of course I went to the opening coffee hour or whatever, and people said, "Well, what are you doing here?" And I said, I made up what sounded like an appropriate excuse, which is, "Well, I'm here, I'm thinking about managing a museum." I mean, do I seem like I'd be happy managing a museum? Not really, right? But after 6 weeks, the light went on, and it dawned on me that I was going to get the same degree everybody else was. And so what I ought to do is open my horizons and start looking around. Now, if I seem, at least describing myself in those early years, like I was a fairly simplistic person, that would be right. I'm a slow learner. I like to keep things simple so I can understand them. Out here in Silicon Valley, unless I can rely on somebody like Don, I'm totally lost. So I did get my degree, and I looked around, and I did decide, to jump high. I went to Wall Street, but I knew there was people there a lot smarter than me. And so I was bound and determined to do something, not that would be easy, but something that wasn't too complicated. And the way I figured out what I was going to do is I worked for a firm called Salomon Brothers. Salomon Brothers, some of you who are young may not have heard of Salomon Brothers. Those of you who are less young may know it for what it was, which was the greatest, in my opinion, the greatest fixed income house on Wall Street in its day. And so if you were in, come on in. If you were in the fixed income business in the mid-70s, which is, hey Bob, how are you? Which is what I was doing at Salomon Brothers in the mid-70s. What were you raising money for? There's really only one thing. Nuclear cost overruns, right? It was one of the greatest paydays for Wall Street up until that time. And so I was just a young clerk, sorting the papers as they came in, sharpening the pencils, making coffee. But I kept seeing these prospectuses, I think, one of those two, coming across the transom all about selling bonds for things like Diablo Canyon out here. You guys are familiar with that. You know how much Diablo Canyon ended up costing? I think about $16 billion. You know how much it was supposed to cost? About $800 million? Less, yeah. So they had this thing called funds allocated under construction. This is this utility accounting system where basically they just borrow more debt, right? There's very little equity involved. They just load up the debt, and they keep issuing the stuff. And so Diablo Canyon went from $1 billion to $2 to ultimately $16 over a period of over a decade. And Salomon Brothers sold a lot of those bonds. I started off as a trader at Salomon Brothers, but that lasted about 6 weeks because I'm not that smart. So what they did was they took any of us who had advanced degrees, and we had an exam. The first thing they did was ask us if we could add columns of numbers. It's a tough exam. Second thing is they said, we want to see a writing sample, one paragraph. And believe it or not, very few people at Salomon Brothers could write a coherent paragraph. So it was the place was run by a guy named Billy Solomon at the time, wonderful man. And he read my paragraph, and he said, John, I want you to have this office right here by the door, and nobody sends a letter off of this floor, which was Project Finance, unless you read it. I said, well, you know, Mr. Solomon, that's going to make all these guys hate me. He says, I don't care. I'm not sending anything out of here that says Solomon Brothers unless every comma is there, et cetera. And believe it or not, technical writing enables you to write all kinds of things, which is what led me to think years later that I could write a 600-page novel. Now, if you're going to keep it simple on Wall Street, why not focus on the world's simplest business, electric power, which is also, take these two things together, in any country, the world's largest invested industry. I don't care if you're in Costa Rica, United States, China. A lot of people think it's got to be something like telecom. Telecom's like 10%. In the United States, medical care, health care is getting close, okay? But it's still electric power. Don't ask me why. There's got to be something, Don, in that equation where you have to spend all that money to make a kilowatt hour of juice. There's got to be some way that over the long run, that's not going to be the case. But basically, if you're somebody like me and you're just trying to find where the least resistance is, watching all these bonds go through Salomon Brothers and looking at the basic parameters, I decided electric power would be a pretty good area to concentrate on. Okay, so that's kind of the boring fundamental learning process. Now we get to, in some ways, the more exciting stuff. You can't be involved on Wall Street or really any walk of life, especially around here with Silicon Valley and so forth, without getting interested in being involved directly in some way with an initial public offering. And, of course, being an art major. By the way, when I got to Harvard, you ready for this? I didn't know how to calculate a percent. Can you imagine? I mean, let alone use a calculator. I mean, like slide rule? Forget it. So this stuff was alluring, but completely mysterious to me. And I kept reading these prospectuses about these IPOs, trying to figure out what was kind of the rule, what was the guiding principle. And of course, if any of you are involved in raising money or asking people who have money for funds, they usually tell you this, right? They usually say it's all about management. Or, you know, some people would say you bet on the jockey, except sometimes, you know, the horse is a nag. But usually people say IPOs are about management. I will tell you I don't believe that. I mean, I think good managements have to be presumed. You don't have to be a genius to run a company that goes public. But you've got to have, right, Don? What we always talked about, a unique selling proposition. So I could figure that out looking at some of these deals. And I thought, my God, I'm in a pretty simple business. It's a commodity-like business, electric power. Where in God's name am I going to get anything that resembles a unique selling proposition? Something, hey, Chris, how are you? Something that can get me to an IPO. Now, right around at this time, 1978 to be precise, Congress decided in its infinite wisdom to amend our basic electric utility law, which, to bore you for a second, is called the Public Utility Holding Company Act, or PUCA. PUCA was passed by the FDR cabinet in 1934 and has essentially remained intact up until 1978 when it was amended for the first time. And what PUCA says is if you own an electric power plant in the United States, that's public utility property. And if you want to own public utility property, you have to go up to Sacramento and be regulated as if you are a public utility. In other words, they're going to cap your rate of return or your rate of return on equity. And who wants to do that? Nobody buying an IPO, that's for sure, right? But PUCA was proposed to be amended by Congress in 1978. Why? Same thing as got me to Salomon Brothers in the first place. Nuclear power plant cost overruns. And Congress figured out that there wasn't enough competition in the power sector in the United States. And so they needed to amend PUCA with something called PURPA, Public Utility Regulatory Policy Act. Can you believe I can say that, right? And what PURPA was designed to do was introduce not only competition, but alternative energy resources into the nation's generating portfolio. And that law was passed in 1978. American Electric Power, what a surprise, appealed the statutory correctness of the law all the way to the Supreme Court, where they lost in January, first week in January 1981. January 10th, 1981, I filed incorporation papers in Delaware for a company called Catalyst Energy Corporation. Now, what is Catalyst Energy Corporation? What was it? Well, everybody on Wall Street asked me that because I had to go out and raise $2.5 million to get started. I said, well, what is Catalyst Energy going to do? I said, well, they've just amended this law. I've got this unique selling proposition. We're going to own power plants, and we're going to be unregulated. So we don't have to get our returns capped. And we've got these tax credits. We've got Congress helping us out. And they said, well, wait a minute. Pacific Gas and Electric owns the power plants out here. What are you going to do? Are you going to supply equipment? No, that's an equipment supplier. Well, you're going to be like Bechtel? You're going to build these things? No, that's a contractor. Well, what the heck are you, John? Now, by the way, if you're ever raising money, if you're ever doing an IPO, and Chris knows this, he's an investment banker, a very good one, by the way, one of my favorite.
And an honest one.
Oh, yeah, he is. Absolutely. Seriously, if you're an investment banker, one of the best things you can tell your client is go home and make up one sentence about your company that describes accurately what you're doing. And if you can't do that, don't ask me for any money, because I'm just the agent here. You know, this fund right here who we see or hears 50 of these pitches a week, right? If you can't adequately describe your company, and okay, I'll give you a couple sentences, no way we can raise money for you. Well, so I needed to come up with some way of describing this convoluted thing that I just explained to you, you know, with like the Congress amending PUCA with PURPA. So I came up with this term, independent power producer. Now, those of you who may be familiar with the industry know that today, fast forwarding, most of the generating plants in the United States are owned by independent power producers, IPPs, okay? Well over 50%. Well, I was the guy who invented that term, and Catalyst Energy was the first IPP, the first independent power producer. And what we did was we owned and had built for us by people like Bechtel, and had supplied for us by people like Alice Chalmers, remember that name, I'll come back to it in a second, power plants. And then we sold the electricity to, in the old days, we sold it directly to the utilities, Pacific Gas and Electric. Now you would sell it out here to the grid, or the so-called California ISO. But that was enough to get me started on my independent selling proposition. So I left Salomon Brothers, filed this incorporation of Catalyst Energy in January of 1981, as soon as they legalized the law. Went out with two partners, and we raised $2.5 million from Bankers Trust. It was a loan. That's unadvisable if you can avoid it, okay? And we had about 2 years till any money was due. That's good, okay? And what we did was we went around prospecting in the two hydro-rich areas of the United States, including California right here, as well as New England and New York, for hydroelectric sites. And I was working feverishly with my team. We were working in an office about the size of this little enclosure right here, four or five of us. And all of our feasibility studies were based on using Alice Chalmers hydroelectric equipment. Anybody ever heard of Alice Chalmers? Yes, sir. Yeah. Well, everybody knows it was a highly respected manufacturer in its day here in the United States. Generally known for their farm equipment and tractors. And, of course, they were headquartered in the great manufacturing city of Milwaukee. What happened to Alice Chalmers in 1982? Just as I was getting ready to raise the money for our first project, they went bankrupt, just like all these companies did across our Midwest. They couldn't afford to pay people, couldn't afford, you know, we all know the story. So an Alice Chalmers hydroelectric turbine, anybody know what a Ford 150 is, like the basic pickup, probably the best pickup out there, at least in the United States? Well, an Alice Chalmers hydroelectric turbine is like a Ford 150. Okay, solid, you can beat it up. It's going to survive a long time, but now they're bankrupt, so I can't use their equipment. The bankers are saying, well, you know, we got to have guarantees from a live supplier. So I asked my friends, and I said, where's the best equipment that I can get other than Alice Chalmers? They said, well, you know, Sulzer Brothers in Switzerland's pretty good. I said, okay, I'll go over there. See this Rolex watch? Well, Sulzer Brothers hydroelectric equipment looks just like this, okay? It's It's as precise and shiny and as expensive. In other words, rather than a Ford 150, it was like using a Ferrari, okay? And none of these sites were going to be profitable. And so I went down here in Silicon Valley, and I talked to my friend Dayu Cheng, one of the great inventors, great minds in Silicon Valley. He's still alive. He's a Chinese man. And he said, well, you got to go to China. And I took him up on it, and that became my unique selling proposition. This is actually a plant that my company owns. But I saw a bunch of projects like this in China. I was the first American to import hydroelectric equipment into the U.S. market. And that made Catalyst Energy. Our sites were profitable, and we became far and away the most prominent developer of hydroelectric projects in the United States. We went public in December of 1984. We were listed on the New York Stock Exchange under the symbol CE. According to Inc. magazine, we were the fastest growing company in America. Went from $1 to $1 billion in the 5-year period between 87. I'm still the only guy who's ever put a hydroelectric plant on the Mississippi River. Okay, not TVA, not Mississippi Power and Light, no one except for me. And by the way, this thing was fabricated as a ship in the Avondale Shipyard in New Orleans, floated 250 miles upriver, and dropped into a channel lock. And so that company went public in 84, and we sold it to a large Canadian outfit, which is today called Brookfield Asset Management. It's one of the largest owners of hydroelectric equipment in the world, for $1 billion in 1988. And the $2.5 million that my two partners and I invested was liquidated for approximately $90 million. So some of you might be thinking, what are you doing here today, John? I mean, you know, a lot of my friends say this to me. Why aren't you richer? Okay? Well, there's a lot of private information I won't go through at this time. But basically, the stock market crash ruined a lot of bright promises, including that of Catalyst Energy. We went from 29 in a day to 3.5. We sold the company for 11. I still got a bunch of money out of it, I'm here to say, but nothing like the $50 or $60 million I would have if we had sold at 29. But I was young. I was 38 years old. So I decided, of course, to do it again. And I decided this time my unique selling proposition would be renewable power. And rather than start a new independent power producer, I decided I'd start an IPP, but this would be the first total renewable power company in the world. Solar, wind, hydro, biomass, etc. Lucian Ruby right here was an early venture investor. He was on our board of directors. And we went public because the moon and the stars and everything, Lucian showed up. We went public in 1992, and we were the first company to build hydroelectric projects in China. So Catalyst Energy imported hydroelectric equipment into the U.S. from China. What was happening over in China? These guys, by the way, that was, I went to China to buy that equipment in 1984. Okay, you can imagine, it's all in the book if you get a chance to read it. You can imagine what it was like. We were flying to Chengdu, which is in western China, and I was convinced that the pilot had erred and had gone east from the airport in Guangdong. We were out over the ocean, we were going to run out of fuel and die because there was no lights down there. I mean, in the middle of the night, I'm looking for a light and didn't see anything. We were invited by the equipment manufacturers in China to come back because they were deregulating in China to allow foreign investment to build, most importantly, power plants. And so I was the first American to build hydroelectric stations in China. And we built five on the Minjiang River in Fujian province. And ironically, we sold that company also to another Canadian buyer, those Canadian buyers. So after I sold, I still needed another unique selling proposition. And I decided to go back to China to get it. And what I've learned over the years, especially in China, it's a very confusing place. You need to set up some rules for yourself. That's what these guys are getting taught right here. And you know, one of these guys is me. This is just like a photograph. So I've got some rules for the hydro business, and I've got some rules for doing business in China. Number one rule for the hydro business, it's really simple. What's your cost per megawatt? If you want to sound really smart, next time you're talking to somebody and they're talking about a hydro plant or a hydro company, just dispense with all the nonsense, because this is about 75% of it right here. What's the cost per megawatt? If you were going to build a hydro plant in the United States today, and this is all in, this is everything from paper costs, you know, getting the permits to equipment, to interest during construction, a hydro plant in the United States today would cost about $5 million a megawatt, five or six. Obviously, if you build a bigger one, because of scale, that price might go down to four. Our cost of our 26 stations, and we've built some and bought some in China, is about 1.3, almost 1.4 million a megawatt, a fraction of world costs. Now, a lot of people say, oh, but that's because electricity is so much cheaper in China. You know that's not true. Electricity is really expensive in China. As a matter of fact, it costs the same at the bus bar, that is where you deliver power from the grid, from the station to the grid, as it does in the United States. So very expensive. So if you're building a plant here that's going to cost $5 million a megawatt, and you can build a plant there, cost $1.4 million, you're selling power for the same price, where would you rather be? Okay. China rule, business rule number one. There's no good deals in fake China. Now, this is a more, this is not fake China. This is where the good deals are, okay? What's fake China? Beijing, Shanghai, Hong Kong. Those places look better than California, I'm telling you. Better than Los Angeles. But there's no good deals there. If you want a good deal, you got to go out where nobody else is. Next rule, capacity utilization. Okay? I don't think I built a hydro plant in the United States that had a utilization better than a wind farm. What's the utilization of a wind farm? In other words, how many hours a year is a wind farm making juice? The best wind farms you're going to see, 25%. Most of the wind farms I've had experience with, 22, 23. Our capacity utilization in China is about 39, 40%. In other words, stupendous. Why is that? Because the sites are still relatively virgin. Okay? Okay. Business rule number two in China. Sell what the government is buying. Said another way, don't rely on the lawyers, okay? You know how we're in a business here and the lawyers say, John, you have nothing to worry about. This power plant is going to sell all of its power to PG&E. Here's the contract. It's 6 inches thick, right? You think PG&E can't overturn that contract? What, are you kidding? I mean, in China, it's 20 times worse. You can't rely on a contract or a piece of paper. You've got to be selling something that the government and the underlying entities need. And believe it or not, hydropower in China is the cheapest form of electricity. There's only one other country in the world where one can say that. Anybody know what it is? Brazil. okay? Hydro business number three. Go where nobody else is. So look at this. You want to try and develop a new hydro plant, maybe up in Klamath Falls, something like that? All the sites are gone, okay? I mean, obviously, you can go to Africa, and maybe after you clear a space to sit down, you can get something done. But this is not Asia. This is China. Only a quarter of the sites are developed. So there's still a huge amount of activity. China business rule number three, be guided by faith. So here's a little funny story, okay? This is the logo for China Hydroelectric Corporation. And when we were forming the company and we had some interested investors in the summer of 2006, my lawyer called me up the day before we were supposed to sit around a table and with the deal people and talk about how we were going to get this money invested. And I said, John, are you done with the papers and everything? He says, yeah, we just need a logo. I said, well, we'll worry about that later. He says, no, you got to put a logo on it. Come on, it looks professional. So I don't have a logo. He said, just make up something. So we had a Chinese lady working with us, Chu Yi Chen, and her brother was a graphic artist. So I called up David. I said, David, can you just make me a quick logo? Send it over electronically. He says, yeah, what do you want? I said, well, why don't we pick like the Chinese symbol for water, make it blue? This is fairly, you know, this is not inventive. You know, red circle around the Chinese water label. And I got the logo that afternoon, sent it over to my lawyers, and we got to the meeting the next morning at 9 o'clock, and there's about 15 people around the table, and my lawyer's looking at me kind of pained. He had this pained expression on his face. I said, John, what's the matter with you? He goes, look, I don't know how to tell you this. We can talk about it afterwards. I said, what? He goes, well, you can't use your initials for the company logo. Everybody see that? JK? Okay. Fate, huh? So this company was going to succeed. Right? Okay, here's what I've been talking about. This is our portfolio. I could get into some technical things. Maybe we will in a minute when we take questions and answers. But these are all small hydroelectric projects. Some of them are run-of-the-river. Some, here's a run-of-the-river project. These obviously have reservoirs. 20% of the world's hydro stations are reservoir-based, which is better. Why is it better? Because you can control when you release the water, because many grids and utility customers will pay you more for a kilowatt hour of electricity at 8 o'clock on Monday morning when everybody's got their hair dryers on than they will at 2 a.m. Sunday night. But our portfolio at China Hydro is about 80% reservoir-based. This is where they're located. These are the two hydro-rich areas of China. The eastern highlands, Zhejiang and Fujian province, Sichuan and Yunnan. Probably most of our development in the future will be out west. Most of the good spots here are taken. We went public in January of 2010. This was nothing short of a miracle. It's always good to get that under your belt. For my next career, I was trying to figure out what I might do, but I've still got a little time left. So anyway, thank you very much for listening, and if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Yes, sir.
Pass around the microphones.
Yeah, I'm curious, to what degree is your advantage, if you have an advantage in China, the consequence of your business acumen, and to what extent is technical information coming from the U.S. important for establishing these positions? Because it's very confusing when you hear how wonderful China is doing and it's going to take over the world. And tell me what the aspects are that gives you an advantage in this arena.
There are two. I'll tell you what is not an advantage. There's no need in China with respect to the hydroelectric industry for any technical information. They don't need equipment. They don't need engineering. They're probably in that area as accomplished, if we are, if not more. My advantage in China comes from three things. Number one, as long as you have access to capital, people want you to do business in China, okay? That may change. They're forming their own equity markets. There's a lot of debt in China, but there's still a paucity of equity, okay? That's changing as we speak. But I have 30 years, 40 years of doing business on Wall Street that helps me, number one. Number two, I have a phenomenal partner. My partner is named Dr. Yusu Lin. He is a so-called princeling. His grandfather was Chairman Mao's kind of combination quartermaster, CFO, and mentor. And he was not a general and not a politician, so Mao didn't kill him off. He lived a long and happy life, and he's a very venerated figure. And Dr. Lin is not only his grandson, which means he is a princeling, but he's something far more unique. He is an honest princeling, okay? Most of these people over there, the princelings are pretty obnoxious, you know, stand around in the hotel lobby with their shades on at 10 o'clock at night. But he is a phenomenal partner. The third thing is that I've been doing business in China since 84, and I'll never really understand China. But I do understand a few things, and one thing they do not appreciate is when a Lawai, that's a foreigner, comes over there and says, well, our way is better. Okay? If you say, well, our way is different, you've got your way and I've got my way, let's figure out where we can meet in the middle, that's fine. Now, that sounds simplistic. What I mean is I can't have my lawyers and our society, as well as, you know, the United Kingdom, we really basically work based on, right, Carol, what the lawyers tell us, okay? You can't do that in China. You've got to find a different accommodation. So now, I would also say China is not going to take over the world. Far, far from it. They have their own set of problems. I'll just tell you what they are very quickly before we take the next question. Number one, in 2025, 28% of their population is going to be over 65. And they basically do not collect taxes or any kind of a safety net to satisfy those people, okay? And they don't have a young population coming up, even one from Mexico, okay, to basically pay the taxes and mow the lawns. So China's going to have its own problems. And I'm going to predict right here that their, let's say, rise is going to cap off in this decade. I mean, you'll see them have to start dealing with those things that I mentioned in the next decade, and I think it'll sober them up. Yes, Don.
So, John, the cover story on Fortune, the last Fortune was on nuclear energy.
Yeah.
I don't know if you read it, was in depth.
Yeah.
And there was a lot on what's going on in China. Half of the nuclear power plants in the world are being built in China. And they had numbers of $1,500 per kilowatt for a nuclear power plant in China versus $5,000 a kilowatt in the U.S.
Right.
So that $1,500 a kilowatt for nuclear plant was about what you had for the hydro.
Yeah.
Is that right?
No.
Okay.
Not post-Japan. I mean, $1,500 installed kW or 1.5 million and install megawatt in China is like those rapid speed trains before they had the accidents. Okay? I mean, in other words, they got them all installed for pretty inexpensive costs. They didn't use gravel in the roadbeds, etc. So what that article also spoke about, Don, is that since Japan, since the accident there, China has put its nuclear program, as far as utilizing nuclear power installations in the country, in the PRC, on a one-year hiatus, and they're re-examining everything. They'll get back into building those plants, but they'll be a lot more expensive.
So the $1,500 per kilowatt, because they took it on, they did it on the cheap,
Yeah.
Because it's like 5,000 in the U.S.
Yeah. And in U.S., as you know, they have multiple kind of checks and everything on everything. That will happen one day. Somebody had a question. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I was just interested in your experience getting to China in the 80s, and particularly given what you said about contracts, what was your experience with negotiations?
That's a great question. Let me put it this way. In the book, and I'm not trying to sell the book, but in the book, I'm not. In the book, there's an interesting chapter. And this, like I say, everything except for the girlfriends really happened. As I mentioned earlier, my first experience in China was buying equipment. One of the companies I bought equipment from was a company in Wuhan called Wuhan Steam Turbine. And when the economy deregulated enough so that foreigners could own a piece of a power plant in China, which was 1992, Wuhan Steam Turbine invited me back. And General Manager Yu was the general manager, which is a very powerful position in China. Another word for it is Daliban. Okay, nobody makes any decisions in China, even today, with many major companies, except the general manager. But he asked us to call him President Yu because he wanted to be part of the new modern wave of management in China. He had many people buzzing around him because they had not only the equipment that they could make cheap, but they had the sites. So he said to me, all right, I'll tell you what. I got these guys, AES, over here. I got these guys, Calpine, all these other competitors to our company, New World. He said, the first guy that gives me a certified check for $1 million has the deal. Okay, now, a lot of people sitting in this room would say, I don't care what kind of deal it is. That's a stupid thing to do. You'll never see the money again. But what I learned was he was desperate. That they didn't have enough money. I mean, you should have seen the shop floor. It was sand. So I said, under certain conditions, I would do that. I came back in 10 days. Remember that, Lucian? $1 million. I had to go to my board and say, this will pay off for us. And it did. My lawyers told me I was out of my mind, but I did it anyway. And it ended up enabling us to develop 5 hydro stations, get one built before we sold the company. And it was just what you had to do in China to kind of meet halfway. And so it worked for us. And still, there's a lot of business situations where if you try and do it like a Western company, you won't be successful. I'm not saying those always pay off, by the way. I mean, it's very risky. Yes, ma'am.
I was curious about the partnering up, but you spoke to that. I will be traveling to China in September, mm-hmm. and I'm curious about how they view Americans at this point, in general, or tourists, or business people.
Okay, well, are you just going to fake China, or are you going to real China? Do yourself a favor.
Right.
First of all, with respect to fake China, let me just give you a real thumbnail sketch, okay? Shanghai is all about business. There's not much culturally there. Hong Kong is an incredible city. It's like San Francisco, okay? Beijing, if there was one city to go to in China, I would go to that one. But as long as you're over there, get out of those three cities and go somewhere else. And that doesn't mean take the tour bus to Xi'an where they have the terracotta warriors in the basement, okay? Go to a real part of China. And, Yeah.
And how do they view Americans?
How do they view Americans? Well, that's an interesting question. And here's the paradox. Like we've all heard around the world, they love Americans because of their candor and their straightforwardness and their get-to-the-pointedness. But also, those things are viewed as negatives in China. As a matter of fact, if you show too much emotion, if you play your hand too early, you're considered a fool. By the way, don't leave any tips any place except fake China. They'll think you're just like burning. They'll think you're stupid. It's like burning your money. Don't ever give them any money. Everybody gets paid. But basically, they like Americans. They want to do business with us. And I don't know that you'll have to worry about this, but I can tell you, for those of us who are in business, the thing you really need to worry about, unfortunately, and this is going to sound cynical, and it is. My mother didn't raise me to be a cynic, but I've learned, okay? They really view us as somebody bringing the money, okay? And, for example, if you're an investment banker like Chris here, or if you're an investor like I am, you'd like to think they're valuing you for your sage advice, your considered conclusions. Forget it. Okay, Chinese people, in my opinion, have both a superiority complex and an inferiority complex. And by the way, I love Chinese people. But when they're in China, they tend towards the former. And when they're out of China, they tend towards the latter. But there's no way you can get most people in China. I mean, they all have 800s on their SATs, right? How can we be anywhere near as smart? And you think I'm joking? I'm just saying that's part of what you have to deal with there. Yeah. Okay. Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Sam Fleischman. I had a question about the comment you made about the handing them the $1 million. When I've been there, in my limited experience, one of the biggest problems I've had is, as an American, is having to deal with the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. And like, so we've been in situations like that where there's been a big bunch of money that had to been exchanged for some reason, and you have to make up a reason why you're giving them money in some cases. Like, so in that case, like that with that $1 million, that was actually for... For what?
It was like a down payment on a development site.
Oh, okay. So it was
legit. Contribution. You want to hear something funny before we continue? We had 38% interest in the project. I was told the project cost $39 million. 38% of $39 million means about $16 million we had to come up with. Remember this, Lucian? Turns out, guess who was the only party coming up with any cash? Right? Remember what I just said to this lady? That was our role, to just bring the cash. But it was a legitimate payment. It wasn't any kind of a bribe. I tell you, honestly, I've never been involved in the hydro business with any official asking me for money. You know why? Because he doesn't need it from me. Okay? In other words, you look at a hydro plant, even like a 40-megawatt hydro plant sounds fairly small relative to some of these big PG&E plants. That's a $50 million installation out in the hills somewhere, right? Nestle couldn't put up a chocolate plant to rival even a quarter of that, okay? So he's going to, you know how the Chinese officials get promoted? It's every 5 years. It's happening right now. So this guy is going to get, or this person is going to get a lot of kudos if he just attracts my investment, whether I'm building or buying. So I've never had a problem with that, but I have to tell you, here's the flip side. If I go to my engineering manager and I just want a $40,000 study done, a feasibility study for one of my sites, that manager, unless I monitor him carefully, is going to go to a consultant and say, listen, I'm going to pay you 40, but you're keeping 10 and you're going to give me back 10, so I'm really only paying you 20. And so what happens is I get a crummy feasibility study, right? And in China, that's not necessarily seen as a bad thing. What I call it in the book is the squeeze. By the way, I didn't come up with that term. It was coined in one of the great books about China written by an American novelist called The Sand Pebbles. If you ever get a chance, read The Sand Pebbles. Read it before you read my book, because it's a fabulous book. But we're not involved with that, so I can't speak with any experience about it, but I think it can be avoided. But it's going to happen, you know? Yes, sir.
You know, I've visited China many times, and one of the impressions you have is that it's the most capitalistic place you can ever imagine.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you're aware of their government, and their government buys American bonds, after all. And yet, does their government get involved in private ventures like this? Does the government also put up hydro plants, and are they a competition for you? And what kind of legal assurance do you have that you, as a small entity, have protection in this environment? I mean,
yeah. A lot of your question comes from being in this wonderful environment that we live in here, where it's presumed almost from our birth that the government wouldn't do some of those things. No such system exists in China, or by the way, other parts of the world for that matter. And so, yeah, can the government decide that they're going to go build the hydro station that I wanted to build in this site? They could. That's one of the reasons why I'm involved in the small hydro sites, okay? Because they're probably not going to pursue the smaller places. But the government in China can do any damn thing it pleases, okay? Now, I'll just tell you a little vignette. This is my take on it. So on October 1st, 1949, Chairman Mao stood up on the dais at Tiananmen Square and was introduced to his loyal subjects as the person who had consolidated the People's Republic of China and starting the new republic. And my view of what happened in the years immediately after that is I think Chairman Mao was very concerned about the country doing what it had always done in the previous 100 years, which was fragmenting into various civil factions, civil wars, etc. Maybe he also wanted to become a cult hero. But in any event, what he decided, in my opinion, was to focus belief in the country on the country. Now, how could he do that with everybody focused on Chairman Mao and the Little Red Book? Now, before you can do that, what do you have to do? You have to get rid of the other things that people believe in, right? So let's start with religion. 5,000 temples in Beijing alone were destroyed, okay? Start with universities and schools. They were all essentially taken over by the state and taught a pablum-type diet of learning. Let's talk about your parents, the most important thing. In the Cultural Revolution, kids were putting their parents into jail and worse, right? So by the 60s and 70s, in my opinion, I'm not a smart guy, but I have studied the situation. Everybody believed in the only thing that was left, which was not Chairman Mao, but the government. And so if you look today, when there's a problem in a village, people don't go to their priest or rabbi, okay? They don't go to the school principal. They go to the government leaders. And the government leaders hold sway over lots of resolution disputes and so forth. So the government really is the overarching power in China. And forget the monikers of communist or capitalist. They love making money there. That's what that country is all about. And the government helps them do it. Anybody else?
We have time for one more question.
Yes, Bill.
you said that based on the population projections for China, that you're predicting at some point the economic miracle or whatever is going to be over. What would actually be the sign that things are really on that down slide as far as them dealing with the economic sort of downturn that's going to come with that? What would you be say that's the key? Now I can predict it is going to happen in 5 years, or it's going to happen in that downturn is going to be something I should.
Well, actually, Bill, I'm already seeing it, and when I say I shouldn't use the I should use the we word. People, my colleagues, people we work with. So what's happening? First of all, there's enormous pressure on wages and commodity prices and living expenses and housing. I mean, enormous pressure. Why? Because everybody wants to join the middle class, okay? And they also need to take care of their aging parents. Are you familiar with the inverted triangle in China where everybody can just have one child? So that means your mother is a single child, your father. Okay, so you know all that. So price pressures are already rising. I think the information that China promulgates on their prices is fudged. I can just tell you, because I not only run a hydroelectric company, I run a private equity fund that's invested in 7 businesses. I would say outside of the rural West, like Yunnan, Sichuan, I would say on the east coast of China, wages are compounding at close to 20%. Okay, now, the government number I see is 7 to 8. I don't buy that for a minute because I just know what I have to pay. If I wanted to hire an analyst in Beijing, this is somebody with a Chinese MBA, not as good as, in my opinion, other places in the world, but, undergraduate degree, Chinese MBA. 5 years ago, I could hire that person for about $12,000 a year. Today, I'd have to pay $50,000 to $60,000, right, Chris? So you can't have price increases like that. Milk in China costs more than it does here, okay? Okay, so that's one thing. The second manifestation, Bill, of what I think is going on in the country is continuous small pockets of unrest and out-and-out protest and violence, okay? I mean, none of us really know because they squash a lot of this information, but my view is there are tens of thousands of situations where some chemical plant dumps some stuff into the stream. People have been managing the stream for centuries for its fishery, etc. Those people go down to the office. They take rakes and shovels. By the way, I'm a very liberal person. I've been an advocate of gun control all my life until I owned businesses in China. Now, why am I saying that? Okay. Well, I owned a silicon smelter in southwest China. We recently entered into a transaction to sell it. And the employees, about 600 employees and vendors selling us charcoal and quartz and things like this, decided that they didn't like our bonus schedule of paying at the end of the year. They wanted to get paid a bonus every month. And we had just taken over the plant. We decided not to do that. 1,000 people with rakes and shovels and pitchforks, no guns, came up our driveway and stormed the gates, started shaking the gates down. So I called my partner, Dr. Lin. I said, well, we've got to get the police. He says, no, they've already bought off the police, okay? So I said, is there anywhere else we can go? And Dr. Lin said, I'll call my friends in the Army. And the Army came down, and that was the only thing that saved us. And guess what? The Army had guns, okay? So I'm reexamining my NRA membership candidacy. But anyway, seriously, Bill, I think that China is going to peak. I think it's a simple matter of the numbers. I also think they're getting ready to step onto the world stage in things like defense and so forth, and that's going to cost them a lot of money too. Now, keep in mind, the economy is doing very well, relatively speaking. But my guess is, I can tell you, doing deals in China is not nearly as attractive as it was 5 years ago. I think the good days are probably over. I don't know. Yeah.
The real sign is when people like you go to Africa.
Burma. Burma.
Brazil.
Brazil.
Everyone who was talking about China 8 years ago is now going to Brazil.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you all for coming. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Questions. Thank you.